Hi, everybody, and welcome to Martin Van Dyke Undercovers,
produced in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library.
In his new book, How Music Got Free, journalist Stephen Witt traces the secret history of digital music piracy from the German audio engineers who invented the MP3 to a North Carolina compact disc manufacturing plant where factory worker Del Glover leaked nearly 2,000 albums over the course of a decade to the high rises of Midtown Manhattan, where music executive Doug Morris cornered the global market on rap, and finally into the darkest recesses of the internet. Through these interwoven narratives, Stephen Witt has written a thrilling book that depicts the moment in history when ordinary life became forever entwined with the world online, when suddenly all the music ever recorded was available for free. Recently, I had the chance to talk to Stephen Witt about his new book, How Music Got Free, and I began by asking Stephen how the concept of this book came together.
Well, I was originally a serial music pirate. I had shown up at college in 1997 with one of those old beige box computers, and that thing had about 2 gigabytes of storage space, which makes it about 1/30th the size of your cell phone today. By the end of the first semester, I'd filled it up with pirated songs. And over the next 10 years, I amassed this enormous library of hundreds of thousands of pirated MP3s. And one day late in the 2000s, I was just looking over my vast collection of music, and I asked myself, God, where did all this music come from anyway? And, you know, I investigated the answer, and I found the most extraordinary thing, which is that almost all of it could be traced back to just 3 people. There was Karlheinz Brandenburg, the inventor of the MP3. There was Doug Morris, the music executive who'd signed all the artists that I loved. And then there was Del Glover, the factory worker who leaked all the music out.
Went back to these three source people. It's interesting. I'm much older than you are. I'm 60. I am very much of a different generation than you. And it's fascinating because, I mean, you literally start your book by saying, I am a member of the pirate generation. And it's as a former musician who's working in radio and very much wanting musicians to be successful and work on their careers and to see how the digital revolution has just destroyed a lot of people's livelihoods as musicians, Stephen. No qualms about pirating all this music over the years? Obviously not.
You know, when we were kids, just showing up at college, it was so easy to do. And I think we never really even considered ourselves as doing anything illegal or even committing the act of piracy. I have the files on my computer. You have files on your computer. We want to trade them.
Right,
it doesn't
right.
feel like a crime.
Got it. Take us into this world of the MP3 and to this man, this Karlheinz character who helped invent the MP3. This is the audio format that we're so used to these days, but it almost didn't happen from what you write.
Karlheinz and his crew had sort of built this thing called a psychoacoustic compressor. And basically what it did was take advantage of inherent flaws in the human hearing system to delete certain frequencies that were, you know, recorded onto a compact disc, but were actually inaudible. So this was a very hot topic of research. Big corporations like Sony and Philips were dumping money into this, sort of knowing that something that looked like this would be the successor to the compact disc. And so it became a very crowded space. Karlheinz had the leading technology of this type, but he was actually locked out of the marketplace because of a format war with a rival. That rival is called the MP2, and some of your older or more computer-literate listeners may remember this.
Uh-huh.
MP2 beat the MP3 in all of the early standards compositions, and so the MP3, even though it was technically superior, essentially became the Betamax of the audio world. In desperation, in 1995, Karlheinz Brandenburg posted his MP3 encoder online for public download. And from there, this underworld of pirates that existed and sort of had as their mission statement to strip all copyright protection from everything ever got a hold of it. And they unleashed chaos. You know, when I showed up at college a couple years later, there were already thousands and thousands and thousands of pirated albums. that they'd created using this sort of legal piece of technology that had been sort of abandoned by the marketplace.
You write about how a song that we play a lot still here on Ann Arbor's 107.1 by Suzanne Vega, Tom's Diner, figured into the work of Karlheinz Brandenburg. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. The way the encoder worked, as I said, was by deleting frequencies from audio. But when it came to the human voice, it was quite difficult to do. You know, the human voice is a pretty efficient means of delivering information. There's not a lot of redundancy there. And so for a long time, Karlheinz and his team struggled to compress that information. Eventually, he isolated a sample of Suzanne Vega's Tom's Diner. And this is a very famous song from the 80s that goes da 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 da.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully we won't get hit with a copyright infringement.
Really, yes. It was not that long, less than 30 seconds, so we're okay, I think.
I think I was off key, so I think we're safe.
We're cool, yeah.
You know, Karlheinz and his scientists listened to that sample thousands upon thousands of times, incrementally trying to improve their compression algorithm and going back and doing it again, a real long process of trial and error. Eventually, they took it to AT&T's Bell Labs in New Jersey and worked with another audio encoding specialist there. And he deputized all of the graduate students at Bell Labs to sort of participate in these experiments. But they got so bored of listening to that same sample of music over and over and over again that they actually revolted, and Karlheinz had to finish the experiment on his own. Eventually, though, they figured it out.
Let's figure out take us into the chronology. My goodness, when the CD format started to become introduced in the U.S., what, about 1982, 1983 or so? This is really like the last golden period for the record industry, because all of us had to, you know, get all of our favorite albums, our Beatles albums and Stones albums and all the new stuff on CDs. And then they were upgraded to better sounding versions. Oh, then the third Elvis Costello set of reissues came out, and you know, if you're a fan, you had to have all of those,
and you got to get the box set.
Oh, then the box set, of course. Yeah. And then came MP3s, and everything changed. And I mean, I grew up working in brick and mortar record stores, Stephen, and they barely exist anymore. And it's all pretty much down to this MP3 technology. When did things start to change in the music industry, when CD sales started to really suffer?
What really happened, Brandenburg took his MP3 technology to the recording industry in 1997.
Okay.
So this is 2 years before the debut of Napster.
Right.
And he said, listen, you guys got to get ahead of this. You got to start using this technology. This is what the future looks like. And the guys there basically said, no, we're not interested. We're not interested in digital music distribution. You know, we're retailers. Now, what they didn't realize is they'd actually been engaged in digital music distribution going back to 1982, as you said. You know, the compact disc was a digital format.
Yes.
But it took them a long time to make that paradigm shift. And here's what they didn't realize, and I say this in the book. They would look at those racks of compact discs at the mall, and to the retailers and the executives and the musicians, that looked like inventory. Inventory that was supposed to be sold. But to a computer scientist like Karlheinz Brandenburg, that's not inventory. It's just an array of inefficiently stored data that should be centralized and distributed and streamed from a server. It took the music industry about 10 years to finally come around to that way of thinking, and they resisted at every step. Now, partly that was because of the absurd profitability of the compact disc, particularly in the late 1990s. The tipping point for them actually didn't come until a little later, probably around 2001, when industry revenues really started to sharply decline. That was actually after Napster had been shut down, but new services like Kazaa and LimeWire and the Torrent started to take over. And more importantly, people started to move things to iPods. With the introduction of the portable music player was a huge blow to the industry, because, you know, you think about it, you've got this 60 gigabyte hard drive. Now, Apple selling songs for, let's say, 99 cents a pop legally. Are you going to spend $10,000 to fill up your iPod? No way. You're going to go out and just get the files any way you can.
Let's move on to Doug Morris. Now, this is a record, a very, very important record label executive. And to
It
still is, right. But to the average, reasonably big music fan, maybe Doug who? You know, a lot of people know people like Ahmet Ertegun, the co-founder of Atlantic Records, or the equally cool Jack Holzman, who founded Elektra Records. I don't know
sure,
if...
David
if,
Geffen.
David Clark Geffen.
Davis, all those big names.
Right, but Doug Morris... A lot of people go, Doug, who? Super important guy. Tell us about Doug Morris.
He himself had been a musician for a while and then a songwriter before becoming a record executive. And in the 70s, he'd actually been Ahmet Ertegun's protege.
Ah.
So he was there when a lot of these acts like Led Zeppelin and sort of the later Atlantic acts were really blowing up. In the 80s, you know, they had sort of a, their roster wasn't quite as good. They had Phil Collins and NXS, probably the biggest names. But by the sort of 90s, Ertegun was sort of forced out of his position, and Morris took over.
Okay.
He pivoted the Atlantic label radically away from these classic rock superstars and towards this brand new sound of gangster rap. So very quickly, he signed the band Two Live Crew, if you can remember them.
Oh, yeah. Notorious band, yes.
Notorious band, and that notoriety fueled album sales. So he continued that, signing a distribution deal with Jimmy Iovine's Interscope Records, and in particular, Death Row Records. And that's Suge Knight's pioneering gangster rap label that had signed Tupac and Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg. So Morris signed all of these guys, okay? Really a radical shift. And he was in his 50s. You know, he was an older white guy when he was doing this. But the controversy was so tremendous that it actually got him fired from Warner. So he moved to a new label, and this was Edgar Bronfman's Universal Music Group. He re-signed Tupac and began to aggressively corner the market on rap music. So by the late 90s and early 2000s, he basically had every major rapper. He signed Eminem, he signed Jay-Z, he signed Kanye West. He didn't personally sign them, but they were on his labels. Cash Money Records, he signed personally. So he sort of built this dominant music force. By 2000, Universal was the largest label on the planet, entirely off the back of Morris's rap hits. And it continued to hold that position even till today.
Wow, so this guy is a creative force. He really, truly is.
He really gets how to market and sell the hits, for sure. In terms of, you know, he's got some songwriting credits. He's got some production credits. But really, his glory days are as an executive, as a businessman, and particularly as a champion of rap music. You know, now, over the last 10 years, he's actually left Universal. He's at Sony Music Entertainment, which is the last of the big three. So there's Sony, Warner, and Universal, and at one time, Morris has run them all. At Sony, and he's 76 years old, last year he put out albums by Beyonce, Daft Punk, and Miley Cyrus. So
wow.
He really knows the game.
And I got to mention, too, that Doug Morris, early in his career, had a hand in a band from Ann Arbor's big hit single. I'm talking about the band Brownsville Station, who are from the area. They had a big single called Smoking in the Boys' Room that Doug Morris, he had a role in that song, didn't
go
write
look
it.
At the producer credit, oh, and you'll find that the producer of that song originally is Doug Morris.
It's Doug Morris.
And he signed that band to his label Big Tree Records in the 70s.
Got it.
Not a lot of people remember Brownsville Station, and most people probably associate that song with the later Led Zeppelin, Van Halen cover.
Van Halen cover, yeah, but originally from here, from the Ann Arbor band. Interesting. All right, so we talked about Carl Hines. We're talking about Doug Morris. Let's move on to the subject of Del Glover. How did you track this man down, this man who is called the patient zero of music piracy and album links? Where did you ever find him? I'd never heard of this guy before.
So Del Glover was a factory worker at the packaging line at a Universal Music Group manufacturing plant. And over the course of about 7 years, he leaked 2,000 albums out of the plant, including all of those major rap acts that Universal and Doug Morris had brought on board.
Whoa.
This gave him an enormous amount of power because he was getting this stuff out of the plant weeks and sometimes even months before it was available in stores. He'd take the CDs home, rip them to MP3 using Brandenburg sort of technology, and then post them on these underground chat channels and networks. From there, they'd very quickly make their way to public file sharing sites like Kazaa and LimeWire. And within 24 hours, you could find this music on iPods around the globe. Again, this is weeks before you could find it in stores. So he was really the patient zero of music piracy, as I call him.
Yeah.
If any of your listeners ever had some sort of questionable files on their hard drives in the 2000s, it almost certainly came through this one guy's hands. It's kind of extraordinary.
How did
the FBI?
How did you do this?
To answer your question, though.
Yeah, and how did you find him? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the FBI caught up to Dell in 07. He pleaded guilty in 2009. I had been looking at this underworld of piracy called The Scene. And what these guys do is they actually have infiltrated the music industry's supply chain worldwide, from London to Japan, including this plant in North Carolina. There's a government database of all of the Department of Justice prosecutions that's ever been brought by the federal government. And I started trolling that database, looking for interesting cases in piracy. And I probably pulled about 100 dockets and read the statements of facts and the descriptions of what people were doing. And when I got to Dell, I was like, holy crap, this one guy has done more damage than the other 99 that I pulled combined. He's just done an extraordinary amount of damage. So I knew I had to contact him, but I didn't know much about him. I just knew, you know, the information from his case file, how old he was and where he lived and his ethnicity. So I started looking on Facebook for people who met that profile. Soon enough, I found a guy who looked like he was about right, and I sent him a message saying, hey, I'm a reporter. I'd like to talk to you. Here's my cell phone number. Thinking, well, if it's not the right guy, there's no harm done. And the next day, he called me.
Next day?
Huh? Next day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And no journalist had ever talked to him before.
I'm stunned. So it's a real one of the many coups in your book. And it's fascinating how he got away with this, hiding a CD behind the belt buckle, huh? So even
That's
if
right.
he went through the metal detector, got wanded, it's your belt buckle setting that off. Go ahead. No problem.
Yeah, he and his Confederates had Universal understood that these unreleased compact discs were very valuable.
Yeah.
They had security systems in place to block leaking, but Dell and his Confederates found ways around them.
Well, let's jump back. I just want to ask you one more question about Doug Morris. He had great success in the music industry and continues to. But was he ahead of the curve in as far as realizing how important that MP3s and this whole digital revolution was going to be, or did he not get it like a lot of other people in the music industry, Stephen?
He won't admit it, but he absolutely did not get it.
Yeah.
He made every mistake. Along with the other label heads, they tried to sue MP3 technology out of existence.
Mm.
They tried to block the sale of an MP3 player. They sued Napster, and they won, but it didn't help them at all. And they sued the end users of these file sharing services, which was a disaster, a total mistake. And I think even many of the recording industry execs would now acknowledge that. But what they did do a little later was start to think critically about where their position was. You know, in my lifetime, we've gone through four format shifts. We've gone from four different formats, anyways, three shifts. We've gone from vinyl to compact disc, compact disc to MP3. And now we're going from MP3 to sort of centralized pay-for-subscriptions streaming services.
Yeah.
And Morris and his compatriots have been ahead of the curve, ahead of the pirates on streaming. So essentially what happened is that they missed an entire format shift, and this cost them an enormous amount of pain. But I think going forward, they have a much better handle on the technology. And the kind of mistakes that these recording industry guys made in the 90s and early 2000s, this kind of technophobic rejection of what was then available, I don't think they'll ever make those mistakes again.
Mm-hmm. What's the future of music, Stephen? Who's going to win this format war with streaming? And what do you see in your crystal ball as far as the next 10 or 20 years in this music industry, which has just been turned upside down in this digital revolution?
I subscribe, and I talk about this at the end of the book, to a streaming service, Spotify. And I recently subscribed to Apple Music as well. Now, nobody wants to do two of these things, so I'm doing this, you know, for research purposes.
Uh-huh.
It's the future. I think once you're paying in this economy, it's very hard to leave. The value that these services provide, from my perspective at least, is terrific. Now, it's hard to tell who's going to win because they're kind of all the same. They all charge $10 a month. They all offer access to the same 30 million or so songs. And they all pay about 70% of their gross revenues out to labels and rights holders. So really, you're just sort of looking at a bunch of different commodities that are packaged in a slightly different way, but it's kind of like Coke versus Pepsi. Like, what is really the difference? Having said that, I do think Apple has the advantage, simply because they've shown in the past that when you have like sort of competition among commodities of this type, they're so good at the cosmetic side of it, just the branding side of it, and that ends up giving them a lot of power. Now, the music industry at large, I don't think will ever return to the profitability of the compact disc days. And here's why. In those old days, you would maybe have an album with one or two songs on it that you liked, but you'd have to buy the whole thing to get it, and that would cost you $14 or $15. So you'd end up buying a lot of deadweight often, a bunch of songs that you didn't really want to listen to. With streaming, it's much more efficient. The artist only gets paid when you press play on one particular song. So if they have, 10 or 11 songs on an album and only one of them's a hit, that's the only one they're going to generate money from. So that shrinks the size of the industry in total because a lot of the dead weight is lost. From the consumer's perspective, it's a nicer solution. It's more efficient. But for the artists, that excess profit they were capturing for many years is probably gone.
Thank you for listening to Martin Bandyke Undercovers and our interview with author Stephen Witt about how music got free, the end of an industry, the turn of the century, and the patient zero of piracy. This has been a presentation of the Ann Arbor District Library.